The News Dissector with Danny Schechter, Fridays at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
And here he is, Danny Schechter, your News Dissector, on every week at this time on PRN-FM, the Progressive Radio Network. Our number here, 888-874-4888. The number again, 888-874-4888. May need your help today because the guest I was hoping to have with me who requested to come on for an hour, who's been on for three weeks. The first week he couldn't remember the difference between Eastern Standard Time and Pacific Standard Time. Last week he called in 20 minutes late. This week he was supposed to be on with me for the whole week. We can't find him. So that's what happens, unfortunately, in the exciting world of radio, talk radio. You book him, you lose him. But we're still here. We're going to be talking about issues that matter. Catherine Waters is back from a stint in Puerto Rico, where she got a little needed R&R, and she'll be joining me to talk a little bit more about Occupy Wall Street and her experiences there. I'll be chatting about it, too. I've just finished a new book called Occupy, a collection of my dissections of Occupy Wall Street, articles that I published on many blogs, including the Progressive Radio Network blog and on Al Jazeera, and that's available so far in a PDF form. So the first 10 callers to 888-874-4888 will get a free copy of this new book, Occupy, which is my basic take on Occupy Wall Street, my reporting that goes back before Occupy Wall Street, and be honored to send it to you, and we'd love your reaction. Greg Palast has written the preface to it, which is pretty funny and pretty interesting. So please, if you want a copy, 888-874-4888, you can call me on that number as well and participate in the program. Today, of course, is the day before Christmas. It's a day when people are, you know, reflecting, some of us anyway, on the year that's gone by and the year ahead, which seems pretty scary. We're thinking and talking about what's been in the news, and we'll be talking about that in a minute. I just wanted to read something to you from the New York Observer that I thought was a pretty supercharged paragraph about the year. He said, "We started with Middle Eastern uprisings and a Japanese nuclear meltdown, either of which might have filled a whole decade in some simpler era, but in ours soon became a back-page news story. And yet, for all its careering, history would seem to stand ominously still." Writing in Vanity Fair at year's end, Kurt Anderson rightly described the moment as creatively stagnant, perhaps exhausted, a late imperial gaga-ing of high empire forms. And this author, Dana Vachon, goes on, "But as algorithms make consciousness a built-in environment, perception itself becomes in some way designed. In some sense, 2011 wasn't totally stuck in the past. It offered a new sensation of being." Drudge's report on Trump's quest for Obama's birth certificate, the snuff film, the death of Muammar al-Qaddafi, and all the rest of it. We'll talk more about it in a minute. Catherine is here with us. Thank you for joining us on the News Dissector Radio Hour based on my blog at newsdissector.com. Stay with us.
So this is Christmas.
So Happy Christmas. I don't know exactly who's doing that version of John Lennon's song that he did with Yoko Ono that has always sort of stuck in my head, the groove for this particular part of the year, a Christmas song that's also about something else, about peace, about, you know, the desire for something better, which is something we all want and we all need. So we'll be talking about that as well as we go through the news of the day and the news of the year and discuss it. And Cat Waters is here, you know, with me, and we'll be chatting and hopefully adding some of your comment. Apparently we have a caller already, Gary, on the line. What's up, Gary?
Just would like to point out the fact that people should get out and demonstrate. I was at the Bradley Manning Saturday protester, and it was a real moving experience for me. It's a lot of positive energy. And if you look at the issues that we're faced today, it's time for everybody to start getting out, because this continuing one body, two party system has got to really stop. I mean, there's one person, I think Gary Noll interviewed him, Rocky Anderson, and he's been on a few programs. But it's time for us to get.
Let's just tell our audience who Rocky is, a former mayor of Salt Lake City, who is going to challenge Obama in some sort of primary. He hopes to anyway, to critique Obama from the left, if you will. He's a very articulate politician, and he's been on with Gary Noll. He'll be on in a lot of other places as well, with a lot to say about the shortcomings of the Obama administration that many of us basically know about but have sort of been quiet about, those of us who supported Obama, because the alternative seems so much worse. On the other hand, we in a sense were, you know, given a bill of goods, what's been called opium. Hopium, is that what the word is?
Yeah.
Hopium. So anyway, Gary, just to wrap up with us, the Bradley Manning protest. Bradley Manning, of course, is the private in the U.S. military who's on trial now for basically giving documents to WikiLeaks. The pretrial phase is over. A lot of the motions of his defense were not accepted by the military judges. That trial will resume in full, and we hope to have a defense of Bradley Manning that's worthy of the case. Meanwhile, the U.S. government is hinting that it's about to prosecute Julian Assange, the head of WikiLeaks, claiming that there's evidence linking Bradley Manning and WikiLeaks and Assange. So that case is going to go on in the year ahead. It's extremely important about freedom of information, about our right to know what our government is and is not doing, and the role WikiLeaks has played in bringing us information that otherwise would have been suppressed. And so important that is. Last point, Gary, please.
I was at the November 30th, the Industrial Aero Defense Finance Committee. It's the same thing. Also, the cops were very, very, I think, civil down at Bradley, the Bradley rally. And the cops in New York, are some of them aren't bad, but this stuff, these cops in New York, I don't think they should take a lesson. They're citizens like we are. And to start beating up on people, that's going to get them worse coverage. And the last thing about Bloomberg saying it's his army, I mean, that's disgusting to me. And I'm a Veterans for Peace member, and I tell you, I just take offense to all of that stuff. But thank you very much.
So do I, Gary. So do I. Right. The number here again, 888-874-4888. If you want to join us in conversation, you've taken a break from New York, Kat. You've been away. Now you're back in the Big Apple. You were part of the whole Occupy Wall Street. You were on many marches, and of course Time magazine has decided that this is the year of the protester. They're actually recognizing that one of the main things that have the new things, the important things that have happened this year is the emergence of Occupy Wall Street and all the protests around the world for justice, for fairness, for equality, and against economic elitism, the 1% dominating the 99%. What are your thoughts? You were away. You had a chance to think about it.
It was actually pretty hard in a way. I really missed Occupy. I missed like two pretty good events, marches, and I'm really looking forward to kind of, you know, getting back into it. I just think the American people really need to get used to stepping up. I think they're not used to it. They're not used to having to, you know, to be a participant, to really... you know, like work for your freedom. It's not just going to be handed to you. No one's going to hand to you, you know, and they've just been, people have gotten complacent for way too long, and it's going to end, and they're going to find out the hard way.
Well, you know, our system encourages this. Our system basically, uses the plug-in drug, which is television, to make us participants, through our eyes, not through our bodies, not by participating actively in politics. The whole goal is to think of politics as something you really can't affect. You can't fight City Hall. There's no point in even trying. You vote, once every 4 years or more regularly if you can. But that's the extent of the political participation that's expected of you in this democracy until, lo and behold, and guess what? You know, a crisis, intensifies, like the one we're having now, a serious economic and social crisis, which has basically driven people to realize that our government is not going to do it for us. I mean, the House of Representatives has a popularity rating of 7% or 8%. So this is not a popular institution by any means. Only a minority even recognizes its value. So this shows you the tremendous disaffection in America with our institutions, a desire for deeper change than anybody in the political realm is certainly talking about. And as a consequence, activists are filling in the critique by raising issues that are not being raised by our major media, not being raised by television and radio by and large, except maybe progressive of Radio Network or WBAI or Pacifica across the country and the like. So there is a need here for more activism, more immersion in active politics. The number here, 1-888-874-4888. I'm Danny Schechter, your news dissector.
Oh, Dan, we have a caller, actually. He was in the last Time magazine.
I think New York Magazine.
New York Magazine. Sorry.
Article. He was interviewed.
Right.
Okay. And introduce yourself. Sign in, please. Welcome.
Hi. This is Yotam.
Hey, Yotam. Thanks for calling in.
Thanks for having me.
So, Yotam, you've been very active in Occupy Wall Street. I get a lot of questions from people about Occupy. Can it survive? Is it going to survive? Is it over? Is it, in essence, scattering or splitting or splintering because of all the government attacks, the closing down of the occupations in so many cities in the United States? I don't know what's beeping here, but what's your thinking about this?
It's a good question. I mean, I think we're definitely experiencing a shift. I mean, we're entering a new phase of the movement. I think that's for sure. I think that's what people are reacting to. It's winter. It's colder out. And we are facing kind of a more aggressive response from people with power. I don't think this movement's going anywhere. I don't think we're going to disappear. I think we're going to get stronger. And I think it's important to relook at the way that we look at winter. Rather than think of it as a time that we maybe shrink or hibernate or go away, I think we need to look at it as a time that we get stronger, as a time to actually grow into a mass movement and do it in a way that, is maybe not as fun as the way that we were doing it before. It means we actually have to organize, and we can look at it as a time to kind of deepen our understanding of the systems of oppression that we're facing and deepen our understanding of the world that we're fighting for, build systems to be able to actually carry out a long-term struggle. I don't think this movement's going to go away. I think the reason for that is that the conditions that we're fighting are real. I mean, they're not made up. Right. This is for real. People really are facing incredibly difficult conditions in terms of, you know, foreclosure and unemployment and debt. And everyone's in debt. I mean, that's not going to go away unless we fight. That along with kind of the decades of hard organizing work that people have been doing that put us in the position to be a movement that we are right now, those things aren't going to go away. And I think another thing that's not going to go away is the sort of magic doorway that we've managed to somehow open. And I'm not really sure how it happened, but it did. I mean, I think what our major victory so far is being able to, I don't know, reveal this possibility that seemed impossible before. And I think that's kind of what's special about this moment. And we've opened this kind of window into what might be possible that people didn't believe before. And I don't think that window is going to be closed anytime soon.
I'd like to just ask you something because, you know, we often talk about the personal is the political is the personal, et cetera, and so forth. And what I'm basically, asking you is what motivated you to occupy, to be part of this movement? Tell us a little bit about you to the degree you can. I know this is not about ego. It's not about individual leaders or spokespeople or what have you. But everybody involved has a reason for being there. And that reason, it seems to me, resonates with the larger public. I was really impressed when in Times Square, when, you know, occupiers marched into Times Square and they basically had some mic check there, and people individually were saying why I occupy, and mm-hmm. It reached, I think, a whole audience that has not been reached. You know, maybe the tourists, maybe the ordinary New Yorkers who were standing by and watching. And it's my feeling that this movement has to move towards occupying the mainstream. It has to reach out beyond the parks and the campgrounds and the occupations into American homes and American lives. So what is it that led you to be involved? And tell us about you a little bit.
I have a lot of reasons for being involved, and it's kind of tough to pinpoint. And I've been an activist for a good part of my life, and I was always, you know, somehow rebellious, even before I was political. I was doing anti-austerity work before this happened, and I was involved in some student struggles in New York. I was at the New School in the New School occupation, and I was involved in Bloombergville, which was a 2-week occupation to fight against the budget cuts in New York, which was this last summer. So I was kind of, you know, so in terms of the practical stuff, I was, you know, around and ready to be a part of a movement like this. But I think the question you're asking is a little bit more, you know, what is it that draws you to this kind of thing, or you know, how do you find yourself in this?
I mean, the reason for that is, you know, we've had a lot of movements over the years and a lot of activism. The whole financial crisis, 2007, 2008, there was very little political mm-hmm. response and reaction mm-hmm. to it, very little protest, as if people mm-hmm. were shocked and stunned or mm-hmm. didn't think it was going to affect them, didn't think mm-hmm. they would be impacted by it, you know, and so we're more involved in the 2008 election or,
right.
in environmental protests or other activism, and yet this seems to have captured the imagination. It has captured the involvement of so mm-hmm. many people in a way. It seems to have found a way to connect with people that traditional movements haven't mm-hmm, and didn't. Mm-hmm. So what is it? What's the magic here?
I think a couple of things. Look, on a personal level, I mean, there are two ways for me that I look at, you know, why I'm part of a thing. You know, part of it is intellectual. On an intellectual level, I think that the oppressions that people are facing right now are totally systemic. They're not coincidental. They're part of intricate and sophisticated systems that produce each other. and reproduce each other and support each other. And I think there is an alternative, and it doesn't have to be this way. And I think it means building a movement that can both pose an alternative and fight to create the space for that alternative to become the norm. So on an intellectual level, I'm part of this because I think that this is a moment that can facilitate a movement like that. But there's also kind of something that you feel in your gut sometimes. And I remember it very well. I think it really hit me when Troy Davis was executed. That was one of the times that it hit me. There's these kind of moments that you can't necessarily explain or articulate as well as you'd like, where it's just, it's kind of, it's maybe it's a disgust, or maybe it's maybe the flip side of the disgust is the feeling of empowerment at your ability to change it. But there's something, you know, it's not only intellectually unjust that there is homelessness. It's also just sickening. It's grotesque. Like, to live in a society that had empty homes, and it's the same society where there are people without homes. I mean, that's a system that does not deserve to exist, and it feels horrible. I mean, it's
Kat the same question about Catherine getting involved in all of this. You weren't particularly a political person. Maybe I'm wrong about that, but you got really deeply involved in this. Occupy really touched you. Why?
Just kind of taking off from what Yotam was just saying, because he's talking about, right, you relate to it in an intellectual level, but you also feel it in a gut level. I mean, it's just like a no-brainer. It's just kind of being in your instincts. And, you know, right, you said that I was not a political person. I was always, my background was always like health and fitness and, you know, alternative, you know, health and healing, which, you know, to me, I think, like, it's all about getting back to that. It's just getting back to the basics. It's, you know, you, Dan, you asked Yotam before, you know, what attracts him to this. And I think to myself, well, what attracts, you know, a white blood cell to a cut that you have on your finger? You know, it's just this sort of organic, part of us that we have completely, like, left behind somewhere in this, you know, we've been so conditioned to money and materialism and, you know, keeping this corrupt system going, that it's just like, heaven forbid, you take a step back and you look at, like, you know, where do we really come from? I mean, we come from the environment, we come from nature, and if we don't connect back to that again, boy, I don't know, we're going down the wrong road fast.
Catherine's the only person I know who so passionately and consistently has a biophysical, biomedical analysis of political problems. It's really fascinating. You know, I should answer the question myself, Yotam, because I also have been very drawn to Occupy Wall Street. You know, for one thing, I did a lot of work on the whole Wall Street crisis in terms of two films and three books. I did a film, In Debt We Trust, Warning of the Financial Meltdown, a book called Squeezed, about the impact this was having on ordinary Americans, a book called Plunder, which was really about how the markets worked. And then I began to think of this as a financial criminal enterprise, not simply a business problem. And I made the film Plunder, The Crime of Our Time, and the companion book, The Crime of Our Time. So I've been detailing it, documenting it as a journalist, as a writer, maybe as an intellectual. I've been writing all these blogs and, you know, articles about it for Al Jazeera and other places. But there was no reaction, really. You know, it was sort of the issue hadn't gained traction. And then all of a sudden, with Occupy, that changed. It changed rather dramatically, and people began to recognize, you know, that politics can be about creating a community also. It didn't really require leaders and, you know, structures from the top down. You can create structures from the bottom up. And I think this approach really resonated with people. And as the occupation developed at Zuccotti Park, more and more people visited it. More and more people felt comfortable being there. They met people who were very articulate, people like themselves, people not like themselves, union members, other people from the communities of New York. By the way, Kat, while you've been away in Puerto Rico, there's been an Occupy the barrio, El Barrio, that has started in Spanish-speaking neighborhoods here in New York and in other places. So this idea is growing, although we don't necessarily see it as vividly without a Zuccotti Park. But this movement hasn't stopped. I think there have been more protests since the police raided Zuccotti Park than even before Zuccotti Park. So I want to get into that, what's happening, what the next stages could be. The number here to call, 1-888-874-4888. The number again, 888-874-4888. Please join us. We'll be back in a minute here on News Dissector Radio.
One of the most important parts of a reform agenda is to encourage people to own something, own their own home. Government must stand on the side of people. Because I understand if you own something, you have a vital stake.
I heard my dad saying we might lose our home.
My home.
3 million families now are said to be in danger of foreclosure. That's a 50-state Katrina. What started as manipulations and maneuvers on Wall Street has now moved to Main Street.
The cascading impact of the subprime mess is clear. No mortgage relief plan can undo the loose practices of the real estate bubble.
What goes up must come down. What goes up must come down. What goes up must come down. And that holds true. Foreclosures have skyrocketed.
Not because they've lost their jobs. Not because of life circumstances. But because the mortgage is pushing them into foreclosure. Never has it happened before. People have the same income.
This is PRN. PRN for the Progressive Radio Network.
This is Glenn Ford.
And Nellie Bailey of Black Agenda Radio.
It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left.
Listen to us every Monday at 4 p.m. Eastern Time, or download our show anytime from the archives on PRN.FM.
Progressive Radio Network is moving forward. We hope you're coming with us.
Love, lust, and laughter on Progressive Radio Network, Tuesdays at 5 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. I'm your host, Dr. Diana Wiley, board-certified sex therapist and a marriage and family therapist. Guests are interviewed, and we sometimes dispense advice to create a format that is both entertaining and informative, along with my humorous sidekick, Billy Sage. Tune in to Love, Lust, and Laughter, Tuesdays at 5 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
Hi, this is Sandra B. Tate of Success Power Talks. You can listen to my show live every Saturday at 4 p.m. Eastern Time, or download it from the archives at PRN.FM. As I always say, take the best and leave the rest. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
This is the Progressive Radio Network, information for the independent mind.
To chase and to Wachovia, Wells Fargo, Sally Mae, to MasterCard and Citibank, and also B of A. American Express and Visa. Yeah.
not a song you'll hear anywhere else. This is Danny Schechter, your News Dissector, back with News Dissector Radio on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com or PRN.FM. We're here every week at this time. Actually, this may be our last show of the year. I don't know yet, but we will have a program on next week, maybe a repeat. I'm not sure yet. The point is that there are voices on this station and on others that are trying to challenge what's going on, trying to offer a critique, trying to offer an alternative, another way of looking at the news and at the world. And that's what, you know, I try to do in my blog at newsdissector.com or my films at plunderthecrimeofourtime.com, trying to offer another analysis, another narrative about what's going on. Clearly, the narrative of Occupy Wall Street emerged to the surprise of many and to the popularity of many, if you will, because somebody was doing something. Somebody was standing up. A lot of people were saying, it's about time that we fought back. It was about time that pressure was put on Wall Street, which really represents the financial credit debit, kind of center of power in America. In fact, more powerful than our government, certainly more powerful in many ways in terms of influencing legislation, protecting its interests, than almost anything else. And the fact that these people are being challenged, recently the head of one organization who's a so-called job creator was quoted as saying these people, referring to Occupy Wall Street, are imbeciles. I don't have to pay any attention to them. How did the imbeciles get to do this? You were part of it back in the beginning, I believe, Yotam. What was it like back September 17th, 2011, as Occupy Wall Street began?
Sorry, is the question how do we react to those crazies, or how did it
start? No, not how do you react to it. How did it happen? What led to the creation of this? You know, it sort of seemed to come out of nowhere for many people.
Yeah, yes and no. I mean, well, look, I think there are a couple of foundations. When you trace it back there, you have to note some of the foundations that lead to what ends up happening. I think one is the conditions. Like I said earlier, I mean, this is for real. It's that you can't fake these conditions. And another is a ton of hard organizing that happens behind the scenes in communities and through a lot of different social justice organizations that are fighting nonstop.
Not to mention examples like, you know, Tunisia, Tahrir Square in Egypt, the Indignados in Spain. A lot of movements have sort of demonstrated that activism is important and can have an impact.
Right, and that it's possible. I mean, I think that's the most impressive thing that Occupy has done, and not alone, but among friends around the world who are fighting back. I think that's the special thing, that we're not uncovering anything that anybody didn't know. And there's plenty of books, you yourself have written like a pantheon of books about Wall Street. It's like, it's not that people didn't know before. It's people didn't believe that you could fight back. I think I didn't even really believe that. And I was there at the beginning and I was pretty cynical about it.
What was it like at the beginning when you were pretty cynical back in the day, you know, just 3 months ago?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, I had been at Bloombergville before that, which was a 2-week occupation fighting against the budget cuts, and it was tiny and fringe in comparison to this. And so, you know, when this was happening, I didn't see any compelling reason to think that this was going to be, you know, so different from that. I couldn't imagine the kind of overwhelming popular support that this would get in so little time. It wasn't the biggest thing. It was a few thousand people in the beginning, and it certainly wasn't as diverse as it is now. It didn't have representation from a variety of different communities, and so it was really hard to tell where it was going to go. And then somewhere along the line, I think, I think the combination of the sort of model, the assembly model, and how decentralized it was, and how able people felt to just plug into it and put their dreams into it without it being dictated to them. I think the combination of that and the sort of intense resistance that came at us from the state made people feel like, oh, maybe this is a real thing.
Also, and, you know, also there was the media role. You know, I'm a media critic and analyst. We just had a panel earlier this week on the media coverage of OWS. It was fairly well attended. It's a good discussion. And, you know, basically, we saw a pattern of, you know, initial media disinterest, ignoring it. Maybe if you ignore it, it will go away. And then the international media here in New York began covering it, you know, seeing it as a sign of something that was a sort of the American autumn, you know, a parallel to the Arab Spring, if you will. They saw its significance right away, well before the American media did. Mm-hmm. And by covering it, networks like RT, Al Jazeera, Press TV, Xinhua News Agency in China, many others, BBC, all of them began to give it legitimacy and validity that the American media couldn't ignore. So the American media came in and initially ridiculed it. You know, the New York Times, I remember an article early on by one of their top writers. You know, it started off like this. His name is Germ. He's, you know, hasn't worked on, you know, ever, you know, it's basically denigrating this whole thing and making it a kind of a joke, you know, treating the park as a terrarium of some kind, you know, kind of a, for those people kind of thing.
Like a petri dish.
A petri dish, right. But then, which is very interesting, something else happened. The police attack, which you referenced a few minutes ago. Now that the state was acknowledging these protests and was reacting to it the way they were, suddenly it existed. You know, it didn't exist before somehow the police clubs started raining down or the pepper spray started spraying into people's faces. Then it became a legitimate story. Why? Because there was conflict. That's what the media loves. You know, when it bleeds, it leads. And in this case, having, you know, activists clashing with cops made good copy. And so the media raced down there. You remember, it was like when one bluebird lands, they all land, you know. Right before 6 and 11, the trucks started coming to Zuccotti Park so the reporters could do live remotes from the, you know, location. And this became sort of a pattern. And suddenly the story became bigger and bigger. And what was interesting about it was they began to do surveys. They would say to people, how do you feel about this? And, you know, three out of five New Yorkers said, we think it's a good thing. Okay? That was shocking. You know, the New York Times reported 50% of the public that they asked and interviewed supported it. So this was something, and they didn't even know what it was in many cases. In other words, because one of the complaints all along is, where are the demands? What do they want? What do these people, what is their program, etc., and so forth. And in the absence of that, they decided, many in the American media, that this wasn't valid because they didn't have a laundry list of demands that the media could refute, you know. But, you know, in a sense, the public sort of got it, and the public wanted to get involved.
Yeah, I was going to just say, like, it's no wonder that they don't let the organizers go back to Zuccotti Park just so that the news actually has something real to, you know, talk about or to put on. I mean, even though a lot of the times they do kind of portray it inaccurately.
Well, you know, I'd just like to say that, you know, I've been writing about this. I have a new book out called Occupy, which has several chapters dealing with media coverage. I've interviewed reporters and talked to people who've been covering it and not covering it. I've been interviewed myself by many outlets, many of them international outlets. I did a program that was on Press TV out of Iran, of all places, actually explaining how the park was running, you know, how the work groups were operating, how the whole democratic structure in the park actually was managing things and self-managing things. This was something that most of the media missed. They were looking for hot-button issues, you know, so-and-so denouncing so-and-so, what is Bloomberg going to do or not really listening to what the occupiers were saying. and not really explaining what the process was. And so, and that's why I've written this book, to try to explain that to some degree. It's in PDF form now. If you're interested in a copy, I'm willing to give away some copies right here if you call us at 888-874-4888. And give us your email. We'll send it to you. I can be reached at dissector@mediachannel.org. And I've been covering all of this, you know, systematically and referencing it on Al Jazeera and other outlets. So your comments and thoughts are welcome.
Yeah, during the break, I texted Yotam a question, you know, that I just kind of, like, you know, wanted to get his take on. What would he say to those people that would walk by Zuccotti Park and just yell at the protesters to just get a job? And I just wanted to hear his thoughts. And what would he say to those people?
Well, I tend to not get sucked into shouting matches with crazy people, but if I had to respond, you know, first of all, there are a lot of people who are out there because they want jobs and there aren't enough of them.
Right.
There are a lot of people who are students who are so heavily in debt and can't imagine getting a job when they get out of school because there aren't any. And there are also plenty of people out there who, you know, are doctors or are, you know, like NTA workers, or they're working all over the place and they come after work.
Right.
So I think it's kind of a silly, it's a silly knee-jerk reaction that's based mainly in lack of understanding and fear.
Well, the way you deal with people you disagree with is to dismiss them,
right,
is to, you know, deny that they have any legitimacy at all, to ridicule them. You know, I wrote another piece this week. I know this is sort of a looking at the question of the death of Kim Jong, you know, in North Korea, you know. And what do Americans know about him, and what do they know about North Korea? They know that he wore elevator shoes. They know that he had a pompadour and seemed to want to look like Elvis. They know that he had a 20,000 film collection of movies, including all the James Bond movies. One of them mimicked him as Dr. Evil, if you'll recall. So that's what we know. We don't know anything about the country, its history, its culture, and what this country has dealt with. You don't have to like the country to know something about it. But our media doesn't really help us, doesn't really explain very much, unfortunately. As a consequence, people get news and information without any context or background. You know, and that's why also Occupy people can't assume knowledge, assume that people know why these protests are taking place. They have to really explain it and engage with people. Many people are angry themselves. They certainly, you know, don't like Wall Street or what they think Wall Street is. They certainly are unhappy about losing their homes or losing their jobs. And or having student debt problems. I mean, there are many reasons to protest, but one of the issues that has troubled me to some degree is how do, you know, we communicate these issues to people who are not now involved, not people like us, not people who are part of the Twitterati, people who are into social media and, you know, Facebook and, you know, kind of a community where communication, social media really kind of bonds it together. But what about the people who are watching late night, you know, a cable TV or can't sleep because they're so anxious about their lives? How do we reach these people and get them involved and make them feel that they can be involved?
Yeah, I mean, look, that's the age-old question of an organizer and a movement builder. I mean, if we had a quick fix to that, we would have won a long time ago. I think that's exactly the question, and I think we've got to do things that are just a little bit harder than what we'd like. You know, look, there's something very attractive and sexy about the opening moments of Occupy Wall Street, which is just kind of this all of a sudden this kind of like the floodgates have been brought down, and all of a sudden there's kind of limitless possibility. All you have to do is put out a call, and you know, thousands of people come out to Times Square. Tens of thousands. And that's not the case anymore. It's just not. And that's okay. That's not sad. That's just reality. Reality is that if you're serious about building a movement and actually having social transformation, it's going to take a while. And it's going to mean activating and mobilizing you know, people, well, everyone. And that means, you know, that means taking on struggles that actually confront the oppressions that people face in their communities. It means creating structures that meet people's needs in the here and now. It means winning things on the way to building a movement. It means going door to door and having one-on-one conversations. It means, you know, trying to amass power to actually contend with mainstream media. It means a lot. I mean, there's a lot we've got to do, and it's going to take a long time. That's okay.
Yeah, I was just going to say really quickly that, I mean, it sounds like what you're talking about is something more along the lines of a committed relationship as opposed to, you know, just sort of like a, you know, one night stand sort of thing. It's like, right, like everybody buys into this, right, the sexy, you know, and they, you know, kind of part of it. But when it comes to the, you know, the familial reality of the day to day of having to deal with, you know, wife and kids or whatever, I'm just kind of using that as an example, you know, like people get a little bit turned off. It's like, oh, you mean God? It's like, you know, like I have to work on my marriage. Like, oh my God, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, let's also recognize a little bit of history here, because I've lived through a number of social movements. I am, you know, part of the 99%, but I am 99, or I feel like I am 99 in some instances when I'm with, you know, younger activists who are just like very new to all of this. I was involved in the civil rights movement in the early 60s, 1960. I was involved in the anti-war movements. I was involved in the anti-apartheid movements. And I've seen the ebb and flow, if you will, of political activism. Nothing really operates in a straight line. Next month, in South Africa, the ANC, Nelson Mandela's movement, is going to be marking its 100th anniversary. And the ANC was the last movement to win, you know, kind of independence or to win back its country in Africa from people who occupied it, you know, the Dutch or the English or the, you know, colonialists. And so struggles do take a long time. And they don't, it's not like an Alka-Seltzer, you know, pill which you put in water, it fizzes, and you're better in seconds. You know, these movements take time, and sometimes they go through phases and stages. They're winning, and then they're quiet, then they come back. You know, I think it's important to have a historical perspective. I remember very vividly, I was actually an organizer, one of the people, you know, small, not an important organizer, but an organizer on the March on Washington, 1963, the one that Dr. King spoke at, his I Have a Dream speech. That's the only thing most Americans seem to remember from that speech. Four words, I have a dream. They don't know that, you know, King was, you know, was not the only speaker, and that the whole march was really for jobs and justice, not just for justice and to segregation. But the point is, you know, that after that summer of activism and mass arrests all over the South and all over America, you know, we had a situation where, you know, Malcolm X had been was assassinated. Martin Luther King was assassinated. Bobby Kennedy was assassinated. The movement, you know, kind of violent spasm, which you know, ended up not really achieving much other than expressing the anger and frustration of so many people. The whole system seemed to be volatile, leading to 1968 when there was a global movement for change, which was, you know, a great moment. I was in Paris in May, June 1968 and saw what people's power can do. And then I also saw how it got crushed. So, you know, I know you have to go, Yotam. Thank you so much for being with us. You know,
no, thanks for having me.
But I'm just meditating here on this historical rhythm of movements, and the fact that Occupy Wall Street is quiet for a day or is not in a park somewhere doesn't mean the movement is over. In fact, one of the signs I liked so much is, you know, that I saw down at Duarte Park, down on 6th Avenue and Canal Street last Saturday, was a sign that says, "It's so not over." It's so not over. So, you know.
Yeah, I agree with that. I actually just wrote a piece about that called Occupy Wall Street Meets Winter, and it's on ZNet and Alternet and Organizing Upgrade. And it's really about that, about using the winter to to you know, build and deepen and grow.
Well, bears hibernate in the winter, you know. I mean,
yeah.
You know, nature again, Catherine, you know, there are plenty of models of this, you know. But on the other hand,
Wall Street doesn't.
On the other hand, yeah, money never sleeps. Wall Street is still here.
Too bad they don't hibernate,
you know,
longer than the winter.
So we're facing, you know, a very uncertain, very volatile future as this year comes to an end. You know, the economy is not rebounding, is not really in recovery. Europe, you'll see in the last few days, the banks have been, you know, all racing to the European Central Bank for money. It's a bailout there to try to keep their banking system afloat. Austerity programs.
I'm sorry. Hey, Danny, I'm sorry. I'm going to have to hop off.
Yeah, no problem.
I didn't mean to interrupt, but
I'm just preaching
so
here. I'm just preaching. Thanks so much for being with us, okay? So I'm just trying to look ahead here, you know, some of the issues we've been covering. We've been covering this economic crisis well before Occupy Wall Street began, with many programs about foreclosures, about the power of the banks, about, you know, the way Wall Street crime operates. And this is something that we need to know more about. Yes, people know about it. They don't know very much about it. I think we need to deepen our knowledge about all this. We need to educate ourselves more. You know, writers like Matt Taibbi, that's been on this program, William Black, the former regulator, who's been on this program, Michael Hudson, the economist, who's been on this program, and many others, offering analysis, offering insight into what's really happening. It goes beyond the media coverage of the Republican debate, so-called, and all the rest of it, where, you know, everybody's waiting for who is the next to fall, basically. You know, looks like Ron Paul is on the chopping block now because of things that were said in newsletters of his years ago. When you run for office, you know, the investigative reporters are all over everything you ever said, and the whole idea is to try to create controversy and to try to discredit the politicians. They're all fighting each other, certainly on the Republican side. But, you know, this is the nature of our political system. It's like, you know, not very pretty, not very edifying. We've been trying to edify, to illuminate issues, not simply, you know, to talk about what's, you know, popular and what's in the news. And that's what I try to do in my newsdissector.com blog every single day. So please share it. Also, our media channel is coming back in the year ahead as Media Channel 1.org, mediachannel1.org. So bookmark that and check it out. We'll have more informed commentary about the media. I'm also writing regularly on Al Jazeera. You can read my pieces there and aljazeera.com, and also on Huffington Post and wherever, whoever will take my work and my writing, Global Research, that does a great job. You know, I just wanted to take a second out to thank all of the people who have carried you know, the articles I post, including the Progressive Radio Network. Thank Jason and Matt and, you know, all and Paul, Robert, and all the people here who have worked, you know, tirelessly to bring you perspectives that you don't hear elsewhere. I want to thank Gary Knoll, who had the vision to create this network and put with his own money and his own energy and time so that other voices could be heard. And Gary's voice has been around for like 37 years on the radio, mine maybe for less, going back into the 70s. But still, it's important. And I want to, you know, just thank all these various colleagues, comrades, in the media world. We need to work together more. We need to cross-pollinate more. We need to collaborate and cross-promote each other more. Greg Palast very kindly wrote the preface to my new book, Occupy. He's a great writer. He's very funny. And, you know, he calls me the Trident submarine of the alternative media because he, you know, says I get under the issues and sink below, you know, to get at the real facts. So I try to. I don't say I always succeed. I don't think every program is as stunning and sterling as it could be. But it's a contribution. It's an attempt to engage. And we'll continue to do it in the year ahead. This program can be heard on iTunes and as a podcast on PRN.FM website. The archives have the URL of the program. If you find it interesting, share it with others. I'll be plugging it, you know, in my blogs. It's been a long year. It's been a hard year in many ways because we're all doing this for free. We're all doing this as volunteers. We were volunteers for America, as the Jefferson Airplane used to sing. We're trying to get people to stand up and to think more clearly, more critically about what's happening in our country, in our world, to ourselves, to become better people, to acknowledge problems that we might have, to engage in criticism, self-criticism, and the like, but also to keep fighting onward. Adelante, forward. That's our approach here. Catherine Waters has been a great partner in this enterprise, helping us. We want to thank her and everyone who's had a hand in this show or in my blog or my films and all the rest of it. You realize you can't do this alone. You realize that this is, you know, the work of progressive media is the work of many people, and we hope that you'll support it, you'll enjoy it, you'll challenge it when you disagree, but you'll tell others about it as well. And Danny Schechter, your news dissector, thank you for being with us this week on News Dissector Radio here on PRN.
Your Honor, for many years, I operated a Ponzi scheme through the investment advisory side of my business. I knew what I was doing was wrong, indeed criminal.
The shine on America's shoes got gold.
When Wall Street stepped into the fold,
Congress paid off, workers laid off,
Stanford, AIG, and Madoff.
Credit swaps, credit stops, empty wallets, and